It's brand new, season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, that face, that lovable face, it melts my Swedish heart. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And I'm not supposed to be here for this episode. I was on vacation, but you guys actually decided to wait for me and let me talk about human appearances changing over time, and it's so exciting to me.
Well, we knew we were going to have to talk about what humans would look like in the future. And Jonathan, I think you are what humans are going to look like in the future.
I am so sorry for all of humanity.
We couldn't really do it without you.
I appreciate that. No, I mean, the more I read into your notes and read the references and everything you guys had really put together, I was really excited to hear this because this is pretty fascinating stuff.
Oh, yeah. And this is kind of part of our series. This originated as part of our series on what we don't see enough of in science fiction.
Right.
Though you do see some of this. But yeah, if you project forward a little bit in science fiction, look a few thousand years into the future, part of the problem is you've got aliens who look alien. And then
It's Star Trek, in which case they look human.
Right. Or
and
yeah,
slightly and then, wrinkly.
Yeah, exactly. There's some sort of ridge somewhere on their face.
And you've got humans who look exactly like humans look whenever the movie was made.
Although, you know, Patrick Stewart as Captain Jean-Luc Picard, you know what? You might be onto something about the future looks like me.
He needs a goatee, but.
Yeah, yeah. And he needs to put on a few pounds. But other than that, yeah. No, we wanted to. I'm okay with it. No, we really wanted to take a look at what's the prevailing thought about what human appearance is going to be? And as it turns out, it's a very tricky thing to talk about for multiple reasons.
Well, of course, you can't really predict, right? I mean, it's one of those things where there's not a clear projection that will be controlled by human behavior.
Right.
It's kind of willy-nilly, and it's kind of random.
Right. There's not like a simulation we can pull up where we just have a slider and we say, all right, let's just slide it forward 50,000 years. Oh, that's what we're going to look like.
Right.
Then.
Three
slide
arms. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we wanted to kind of talk about some of the scholarship behind this and the thoughts behind this and really kind of dive into this topic and talk about some of the possibilities.
Right. So just last year, there was actually a funny news story and then a lot of back and forth between people in the media and the scientific community about this one particular article that Forbes published.
Right. It went pretty viral. They published this tech blog and or article and or content piece. I'm not sure exactly what category
it fell
in.
Into.
Right. It was called How the Human Face Might Look in 100,000 Years.
So this was June of last year.
This was June of 2013, correct. Okay. And in it, Forbes staffer Parmi Olson reported on work that had been done by this digital artist named Nicolay Lam in collaboration with a computational genomist named Dr. Alan Kwan.
I didn't even know computational genomist was a thing.
Me neither.
Pretty awesome.
Congratulations to that guy. and so in their work, they speculated on what the face might look like in 20,000, 60,000, and 100,000 years.
Okay, so what did they come up with?
Well, you guys might have seen a picture of this somewhere. It basically, the furthest view out was this sort of anime character-looking thing.
Right.
Okay.
Gigantic eyes.
Gigantic eyes, kind of weird, big forehead, and...
Yeah, now, so far sounding like me. No, my eyes are not gigantic.
I
do have the weird big forehead, though. That's okay.
So their predictions fall into a few broad categories. Okay, they suggested that the forehead will get longer and wider to accommodate a larger brain.
Okay.
We'll talk more about this way at the end of the podcast. That the eyes will get larger, approaching, and I quote, unnervingly large.
this is what we call Disney princess large.
Yeah.
As we adapt to dimmer off-Earth environments.
Okay. And as we become more innocent.
Right. That our nostrils will get larger and our hair denser to help with breathing and heat retention off-world.
Now, wait, I hope the timeline on this is really accelerated because that hair density thing is very, very pertinent to me.
That our skin will get darker to help combat UV radiation outside of Earth's ozone.
Okay.
That we'll ditch wearable tech for subtle implants.
Okay.
And that perhaps most importantly, genetic manipulation will render natural evolution moot, likely resulting in increasingly normal human features with an emphasis on symmetry and the golden ratio and that kind of ideal.
Right.
Of human.
And normal.
Beauty.
Yeah. Normal and ideal there being in quotation marks.
Really heavy quotation marks in case you can't tell my sarcasm voice, which I am told sometimes sounds a lot like my normal voice.
Well, yeah. No, the exactly. Because normal, I mean, who defines what normal is in this case? And they're specifically looking at these ideals, which have been held up as ideals only by certain types, certain cultures. Yeah, you got to take that with a grain of salt.
Yeah, another thing to note is that they're not suggesting that this is how humans will grow to look because of, say, natural selection. They're saying that this is how we will basically decide to
We'll engineer ourselves.
That we will choose features and, you know, so Gattaca-esque, everyone will end up looking like Jude Law.
Well, I'm okay with that, too.
Actually, me as well.
But yeah. Pretty man. But anyway, the what I was going to go into here is that some of this kind of makes sense from sort of a top level approach, right? The idea that if we are to go colonize other planets, there will likely be situations there that will be different enough from what we have here at Earth that we would need some form of adaptation to be able to thrive on said planet. And so while it might not be efficacious for us to wait for evolution to take hold so that whichever humans survive that initial colonization end up producing generation upon generation upon generation, multiply that out 10,000 times till you get to a group of human beings or what used to be human beings who are ideally suited for that planet, it makes more sense that we would be taking an approach where we're making those choices consciously.
Well, I mean, these days in the ideal scenario, we do all we can to prevent natural selection from happening to humans.
Pretty frequently, yeah.
Yeah.
I had a joke, but I'm going to leave it on this case. You can thank me later.
Okay.
All right.
So an observation I had about their predictions is that if you just take them as like, these are some kind of fun, interesting guesses, I think they are interesting.
Oh,
that's
totally.
That's cool to go with. But there's sort of the question of like, at what level are these being pitched? Are they just saying, here are some interesting suggestions? Or are they saying, we've got a pretty good idea what humans are going to look like? And I think that exact distinction was embodied in a lot of the responses.
Oh, yeah, because there was this whole flurry of response on the internet. Do you believe that the internet took something way more seriously than they perhaps should have and blew it out of proportion? I'm sorry. My sarcasm voice is strong today. and I do want to point out here that Nicolay Lamb is the guy who created that Average Barbie doll that also went viral in 2013. If you remember the side-by-side photos of a store-bought Barbie with a Barbie who is shaped more or less like a human person.
Right.
He's that guy. He also is behind the Lamely doll line, which he kickstarted in 2014 to work towards producing realistic shaped dolls for kids. Because, okay, a thing to keep in mind about Lamb's work is that he's really savvy about producing stuff that will capture the public's imagination and click-throughs.
So, in other words, like, this could be something where he imagines a scenario and then frames it in such a way that it's compelling enough for people to look at, participate in a discussion about, but doesn't necessarily indicate any kind of expertise necessarily that or scholarship that went into the ultimate design or guess.
I think very much that that he and the other fellow Kwan were trying to make an interesting thing,
right?
Perhaps more so than an extraordinarily accurate future prediction.
Well, and one other thing I would point out, and some of the other discussions we're going to chat about will sort of fall into this as well, is that while we could go the engineering route to try and tackle some of these issues, another thing we could try besides, altering ourselves is altering the environment we're going into. And therefore, you wouldn't have that environmental requirement to adapt. We could adapt the environment, which is pretty much what humans have been doing for the last couple hundred years.
Yeah, typically we don't biologically adapt to our environments anymore. We adapt the environments or we technologically adapt.
Right.
You don't need crazy anime eyes if you have lamps.
Right.
So.
Right. That's a good point. Are you telling me that
Jonathan,
pitch dark couldn't happen? Or is it pitch black?
Pitch black.
That pitch black couldn't happen because, that's actually a good Vin Diesel movie and you're going to destroy one of the few good Vin Diesel movies.
I'm not going to take pitch black away from us.
All right. Thank you.
I think the thinking is that huge anime eyes would help protect the environment because you wouldn't need to use as much energy on lamps. In situations where energy is scarce.
Actually, I'm pretty sure
this could solve our energy problem.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure, and I know you're making a joke, but I have to be the jerk who comments on this. I'm pretty sure by the time we're colonizing other worlds, we've kind of nailed the energy problem because that would necessitate us being able to get to said other world.
Yeah, but off world is always like the crazy Wild West.
Yeah,
but
with fusion reactors.
Yeah. Okay, Lauren, you mentioned a couple of the people who responded to this original article and the illustrations that these people did. What were some of the responses?
They were interesting, and we're talking a lot about this particular prediction because the conversation that it generated really was fascinating, even if it was blown out of proportion. So George Dvorsky for IO9 thought that Lamb and Kwan's ideas actually didn't go far enough. He suggested that they should have taken into deeper account the possibility of technological additions and innovations to human biology, including the idea that we might be totally cyborgs or have uploaded our consciousness or be controlling robotic avatars from a distance. He didn't really comment on the idea that humans might want to stay human-looking, which is...
That's something I want to talk about in a bit here, but we can save that.
Yeah, sure. I've got some stuff. I think Joe and I are going to throw down in that part of the conversation.
I hope so.
Yeah.
All right, just keep the fight on that side
of the
table.
There was actually another writer for Forbes responded, though.
Huh. Yeah, Matthew Herper wrote a fairly snippy response entitled, and I quote, "No, this is not how the human face might look in 100,000 years." In it, he suggests that the genetic engineering that Kwan and Lam hypothesized about is going to be taking place much sooner, and also points out that 100,000 years is only about half the time that Homo sapiens have existed as such. You know, that this is
anatomically modern.
Right. This is basically minus, you know, grooming and a little bit of skull size difference. This is how we've looked for that long. So you know, A, it's unlikely that major facial changes will happen in so short an evolutionary period of time, mm-hmm. and B, that it's impossible to say what tastes and trends will be like in the future, so therefore guessing what features we as geneticists and or consumers are going to select in the future is just pure sci-fi speculation.
Right. I mean, for one thing, we cannot anticipate what a generation that's 500 years removed from our own is going to perceive as being desirable or attractive.
Jumpsuits. Nothing but jumpsuits.
I mean, Fallout has taught us many things. But no, but seriously, we can't predict what people are going to find attractive about the human form in one way or another. And that's part of what we'll really go into our discussion a little bit later too. So, it's really difficult to suggest that. Also, as far as this genetic engineering thing about how it's going to happen much sooner, that one I'm really curious about because I foresee there's going to be a lot of resistance on that front for a long time, for various reasons, including ethics. So,
right. You're saying it's not just that we might not have the technological expertise to do it, but that there might be reasons not to do it.
There will be cultural and social taboos against genetic engineering, at least in certain parts of the world, for a good long time is my guess. That's a guess because we don't have enough right now to really say one way or the other. But just based upon the reactions we've seen to basic foundation research that would lead maybe one day to genetic engineering, we've already seen examples of people really kind of putting up barriers.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Also, I think that a few of these nice people brought this up, that if we're going to do genetic engineering, we're probably not going to be piddling around with eye color. We're going to be, say, like wiping out really terrible diseases.
Yeah, sure.
And stuff like that first. And
right.
Then maybe after that, like, you know, my nose is a little bit big. I'd like to give my daughter a smaller nose. Is that possible?
Yeah.
I mean, stuff like that.
Yeah. I've got more to say about that in the next setting, too. Just because human history is filled with people altering themselves.
Oh, sure. So, I mean, my hair is blue right now, so I totally get that. But I wouldn't want to be born with blue hair. I'm not sure. Anyway, so there was a response, actually, to Herper's response.
So a response to the response.
Yes. Kwan actually wrote him this really sick burn email.
That was the computational genomist.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Who worked on the original hypothesis here.
Right.
And in which Kwan said, and I think this sums up his, I mean, it was a really long email, so I'm just going to quote part of it, but mm-hmm. I think it sums up his overall argument really well. Okay, so here we go. The operative word might, as in this is what the human face might look like in 100,000 years, makes the statement an existential statement, which means that there is a non-zero possibility that a given event may occur. Given that we agree that no one can make an absolute statement about the future, by the same token, you cannot claim to know the negation of an existential statement. This is not how a face might look like, or its equivalent. There is no chance that the human face will look like this.
All right, but I see this other thing in our notes here. This is kind of interesting to me. The question about whether or not we will be taller.
Yeah. This is something that I think has often sort of been imagined. It might be that we will get taller in the future.
Or that we are currently very tall compared to our ancestors, which, I mean, if you've ever been in an old house, it's...
Yeah,
yeah.
Or a castle. I just walked around a few castles, and there were times where I had to duck my head, and I am not a tall person.
Well, it depends on which ancestors, it turns out, and that's going to come into something. But there's this question. Have we grown taller than we used to be as a species, and will we continue to grow taller as time goes on? So I want to start with one fact. A March 2014 paper in the Oxford Economic Journals found that from the mid-1800s to 1980, the average height of European adult males grew 11 centimeters. That's about 4.3 inches.
That is significant.
Wait, that was in the Oxford Economic Journals? Was it based upon how expensive it is to build higher doorways?
No, it turns out actually studying human height factors into economic papers a lot.
Oh,
because,
interesting.
It may reflect certain economic conditions in society.
Like food sources.
A little bit of a spoiler, but for how this discussion is going to turn out. But there was also this other thing I found online that was funny. It was, quote, a living bar graph. So it was a comparison of height distribution among students at Connecticut State Agricultural College, comparing photos taken in 1914 and then 1997. So they had different bars, basically, with like a 5'2", 5'3". Mm-hmm. And then they'd have the students who measured those heights line up behind each bar. So you'd get a bar graph made out of actual humans in the photo.
Okay.
Gotcha.
And you can see over time that the distribution of male students goes up. So the average height of the male students was 67.3 inches in 1914, and that increased to 70.1 inches in 1997. That's a difference of 2.8 inches or 7.1 centimeters in just 83 years. Now, of course, there may be some self-selection in this because the Connecticut State Agricultural College started offering scholarship packages to taller students in the 1950s.
That was just tough. I mean, you know, if you were below average height, you got the short end of the stick on that one.
Was totally a joke. They did offer scholarship packages to taller students. No, the students actually.
Mine wasn't a joke because to be a joke, you have to be funny first.
Okay. So they add the male students actually did get taller on average. So there are more comparisons of average male height over time than average female height. For example, the living bar graph from Connecticut, there are no women in the 1914 photo. The women in the 1997 photo average 64.8 inches.
But don't worry, in another 83 years, we'll be able to compare both men and women.
Yay.
I'm sure.
So, can we get a more general estimate? Like, does this apply to women too? Yeah, it seems like it. So, in a 1998 guest article for Scientific American, the biologist Michael J. Doherty claimed that the average height of humans in industrialized countries had grown by about 10 centimeters or 4 inches over the past century and a half.
Okay, well, let me ask you this, Joe. Does this mean that we as a species are evolving rapidly to become like the next generation of NBA players? Is that what this is all about?
Sadly, no. So what scientists have discovered is that they think we are not evolving to grow taller, and there are a bunch of reasons for thinking this. Number one is that it hasn't been a steady progression of much shorter people long ago to much taller people now. Mm. Instead, if we study history, it seems to be inconsistent. People get taller, and then they get shorter, and then they get taller again.
Are there any correlating effects that seem to go along with this taller, shorter, taller thing?
Which perhaps we may have alluded to
just
previously, a moment ago.
Spoiling this part of the podcast.
So yeah, we observe around the world and in recent history that generations of children who suffer poor nutrition in early development remain shorter as adults. And when economic conditions improve and the next generation receives better food, those children tend to grow up to be taller adults, mm-hmm. is what we seem to observe. There's this study called anthropometric history, and that's the study of historical trends in human height. In the past couple of decades, people in this field have largely used the historical distribution in human height to study environmental and economic conditions, not population genetics.
Huh. Yeah, makes sense.
And finally, that as far as we can tell, we sort of seem to have leveled off. So while these increases in average height can be charted over the past century and a half, we're a lot taller on average than we were 150 years ago. People in industrialized nations aren't really getting much taller anymore. We seem to have kind of hit the max.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, that's all right. I wasn't expecting to grow any taller than I already have. Figured that my growth spurts were behind me.
Every day.
To be a little taller?
To be a little bit taller.
Yeah. Well, you know, we should put a little mark on the wall and just have it being Lauren's height. And we just have her stand under it every day. We take another picture.
We'll test the power of wishing.
It's a scientific experiment.
That sounds like testing the power of how tall the heels I can wear are.
Okay. How about brains? huge, huge brains.
Yeah, part of that facial features guesstimation was the forehead will grow because our brains will get bigger.
Right. So therefore, we'll need more space in our heads hold those big old brains of ours.
Have you ever seen a movie called This Island Earth?
Yes, I have. You're talking about the aliens with the enormous brains,
which are veiny skulls. Yeah,
two different kinds, Lauren. Let me parse it for you.
Oh, okay.
First, you had the regular human-looking aliens. They just have hilarious...
Human-looking is being generous.
Okay, they have hilariously huge foreheads. Like, you just had to cram an extra brain in there, so they made the skull bigger.
So a little bit cone-headish.
Yeah,
almost.
It's why the MST3K version of it has one of the characters, one of the robots, just every time the alien leader has a line to the humans and he's posing as a human, is you just hear one of the robots say, "But I'm not an alien."
But then later in the movie, you get an alien, this brain mutant. So it's just got a huge bulging brain, and that's basically its head.
And like
it's
crab
just
hands.
An exposed giant brain with goggles. Is that what we're going to be? Because obviously we want our brains to get more powerful. If we're thinking that we're going to continue to upgrade our intelligence, if we can genetically engineer ourselves to be smarter, that's got to mean we're going to have gigantoid brains, right?
Well, first of all, let's look back at history, right? We need to look back at our ancestors and the predecessors to the humans.
Sure, and it's certainly true that human brains are hominid brains, at the very least, have gotten much bigger over the past, say, 2 to 3 million years.
Yeah, that's right. So our brains have more than doubled in size since more than 2.5 million years ago. But does that necessarily mean that size is directly correlated with intelligence? There are some correlations, but it's not a totally direct correlation.
Oh, right. It's not one-to-one, certainly.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are some studies that show that brain size and intelligence are not so closely correlated that, you know, you would say, oh, this person has a larger brain, therefore they are automatically smarter than this other person.
Right. So one example I'd like to give is that on average, men have slightly bigger brains than women, but don't take this and run with it, you woman-hating jerks. That does not mean men are smarter than women. In fact, men are not measurably smarter than women. It seems that, for example, one thing explaining part of this is that women have more densely crowded neurons in some parts of the brain, the cerebral cortex. Women may have up to 12% more neurons in the cortex than men. And then there is the fact that it's actually the brain-to-body mass ratio that is a little bit more predictive of intelligence. But even then, you have some variation with that.
Sure. Well, like an elephant's brain can weigh 4 times that of a human's, and they, as far as I know, don't do many of the complex things that we do. If they do, they're really good at hiding it. No, they need those big brains to control their huge muscle blocks.
Mm. Well, that makes sense.
There's also within the human species itself, the largest Homo sapiens brains on record belong to the Cro-Magnons, which were a subset of early modern humans who lived some 20,000 to 40,000 years ago. And some people theorize that they needed those bigger skulls not to, you know, do computational science, but rather to chew their less refined food, or, you know, simply having a thick skull to, like, survive infancy was really useful.
Yeah. I don't know. They might have been calculating how long it would take them to chew that food.
It's possible.
So it's, you know, we can't put it past
them. I don't know.
I've
never asked one.
I want to throw an even bigger wrench into this and say, okay, so we've established that it's not necessarily just a brain size issue. Brain size is correlated to intelligence, but it's not a one-to-one thing. But this is the craziest thing. Our brains may not even right now be the biggest they've ever been. Modern humans, we should probably say, are the most intellectually advanced species as far as we know. I mean,
right. The most intellectually advanced ones that we've encountered at any
right.
rate.
And not including dolphins.
And certainly for smarter overall than Cro-Magnons.
Probably.
Yeah, most likely.
But what if our brains had been bigger than they are now?
There is evidence that they have been shrinking recently. According to paleoanthropologist John Hawks in this really great Discover Magazine article, over the past 20,000 years, the average volume of the human male brain has decreased from about 1,500 cubic centimeters to about 1,000 350. And that's, okay, conversions are awkward from metric to imperial. That's like 6 1/3 cups of brain to about 5 2/3 cups of brain, or like 3.2 pints to 2.85 pints. It's a chunk about the size of a tennis ball.
Didn't need it.
And women's brains, for the record, have shrunk proportionally as well.
So wait a minute. How are they explaining this? Are we getting dumber than we used to be?
Well, okay, so they've...
Tread carefully.
Different paleontologists and anthropologists have different theories about why and how and the exact effect that this is having on humans as a society. The first is that, yeah, we're getting dumber.
So the Cro-Magnons were not less intelligent, though.
Either due to something like, have you guys seen Idiocracy?
Yes.
Yeah, just the lowest common denominator becoming the greatest denominator. And or that as a society, you know, being a society means that we don't have to be so smart to stay alive.
Individually, there is not as much of an imperative for intelligence because collectively we're able to handle so much.
Right. Hmm. Right. Another theory put forth is that our brains are getting more efficient, both more agile and also more energy efficient, allowing us to concentrate less on food and more on playing really awesome guitar riffs.
Well, okay. Yeah.
Sure. Or perhaps that we've domesticated ourselves. A marker of tame animals after many generations is a smaller brain size.
Which, again, kind of goes back into that idea of they don't need as large a brain because they don't have to rely so much on survival skills because they got a big old dumb human taking care of them.
Right. Finally, that our changing diet means that our food is so much easier to eat that our skulls don't need to be as big for us to chew it. And also, I mean, I don't think that we mentioned this before, but a definite impediment to, you know, ludicrously large, unnervingly large brains is that the human birth canal is not getting proportionately larger anytime soon, I don't think. I mean, it would require the birth canal to get larger or human hips to get larger.
Well, by that time, we'll all be born in artificial wombs.
Oh, okay. Yeah, like the Matrix. We'll just be in little pods. Yeah. Okay. So
I think by that
solved.
Time, we're actually gotten to the point where our brains are just in jars. And so then you'll be bragging to everyone else about how big your jar is.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to switch to a different topic.
Okay, please do.
Are we going to become the Borg? Because this is what everybody imagines, right? So we're heading towards the singularity. We're going to start incorporating more technology into our brains, into our bodies to supplement all the things we can't do with these weak, puny little muscles and the gray matter up here. Why not just cram computers into our skin so we'll have little wires and circuit boards popping out everywhere? I feel like this sort of ties into Dvorsky's comment on the first article we were talking about.
He
seemed to think we weren't going far enough.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, if I could replace one eye with little blinking LEDs that say something clever in Morse code, I probably would today.
Okay.
There you go.
All right, well, Joe, I want to hear your point of view on this, because then I want to engage in a discussion about this, because I have some thoughts of my own.
Yeah, okay. Well, I kind of doubt that. I mean, I don't know. Maybe. Because, of course, human culture and what we find attractive is it's adaptable, we know, to some extent. We don't know to what extent. And I would guess, based on my affinity for something called the biophilia hypothesis, that we probably aren't going to want ourselves to look too computery and machiny.
Mm-hmm. That hypothesis is the E.O. Wilson one, right?
Yeah, so this is put forth by E.O. Wilson. There have been a lot of people who have written about it. And the biophilia hypothesis is what it sounds like. It's the idea that living organisms like humans have an inherent, deeply instinctual affinity for other living organisms and living systems, so that we are always going to prefer organic life to artifactual synthetic types of objects. Mm-hmm. And that humans, you'd always prefer a forest to a room with concrete walls. And okay. that goes deep. It's not just sort of a cultural institution like, oh yeah, you know, forests are nice because I learned that when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
It's part of the animal that we are to prefer those things. It's still a hypothesis, of course. That's not something that's proven to be true, but that it seems to ring true to me.
Interesting. So,
and of course, sorry to complete the thought.
Sure.
How this would apply to humans would be to say that, no, maybe our cultural appreciation for what humans should look like, it can change, but it doesn't go that far. It doesn't go to the point where we want humans to stop looking organic.
Sure. Like, you know, taking it back to the Borg kind of reference, there's probably a reason that the Borg were these horrifying villains and not really the good guys, until we got a sexy lady Borg who was okay to be one of the good guys because we had taken most of that weird computer stuff off of her
Well,
face.
And there's some things, and we've referenced some of this earlier, there's some things that if you were to change them about the human face, they do, for most people, elicit a sense of unease or even horror. We've seen that used to great effect in horror movies, where you often have villainous human characters, or quasi-human in the case of some of these, because they appear to have some sort of supernatural element to them. Right, yeah. But they often have faces that are asymmetrical, or you will end up creating a sense of horror by taking a person's face and then suddenly distorting it in some way. There's the scene in The Ring where it's a very quick flash of a person whose face has been distorted, so like their nose has been misplaced, their eyes get a little out of alignment, and it does create a really shocking sense of unease among a very wide audience. I mean, mm-hmm. It's just one of those kind of reactions.
Uh-huh. And quick sidetrack on that one. I think that that's what Lam and Kwan were talking about with the golden rule and symmetry. Because
you mean the golden ratio?
The golden ratio. I totally said the golden rule.
Do unto your face as you would have other faces do unto you.
I live by that rule.
Yes, the golden ratio. Thank you, Joe. Because one of the markers of beauty, and I mean, of course, beauty is in the eye of the beholder and all of that kind of stuff. But no, it's also scientific that a symmetrical face is considered beautiful.
Well, a couple of things I wanted to say. One of them is actually in the notes, which is that the any sort of technological enhancements do not necessarily mean we are going to have great cosmetic changes in a person's appearance.
Right. That's one thing I predicted is that, well, it seems pretty obvious that if we can upgrade your brain with computers, we can probably do it in a way that's not going to be too visually obtrusive.
Right. There might be some that people choose to have. Like you were talking about an LED light that blinks out Morse code in place of an eye, Lauren. But
that was just a Patrick Stewart Borg reference.
But even so, even though that's a joking reference, I could easily see technological enhancements or body modification being something that gets embraced by perhaps at first a
counterculture,
a subculture, but then get embraced by a larger culture. And the reason why I feel pretty confident about that is that human history is filled with examples of people undergoing various types of body modification in pursuit of some sort of perceived beauty that was supported by that culture. There were a lot of different reasons for something to be seen as beautiful, depending upon the culture. For example, there's the foot binding in Chinese culture, which was in part seen as the ideal of female beauty was to have that lotus foot. It was also in part as a means of subjugating women. So it's all, you know, culturally tied up. It's not just like this is what we consider to be beautiful.
Very complex.
It's very complex, exactly. But the fact that we've seen things like piercings and tattoos become more accepted in a Western culture over the last, I mean, even in my lifetime, I've seen that. The fact that I have a shaved head and that is considered to be culturally fine in America, that has changed. When I first started doing it, it was before you saw it pretty frequently. And so I don't know if guys just were holding on to their hair more back then, but I frequently encountered people who had not really talked to anyone who had ever shaved their head.
Wow.
It was really an unusual experience for them. So I had a lot of people asking if they could touch my head. Thankfully, that part of my life is behind me, I guess, because now we've hit a kind of
saturation point
of bald guys, particularly the bald guys with goatee Heisenberg appearance. So at any rate, we've seen changes in ideas of beauty and modification happen over the past. So I don't think that we will necessarily see a future where this sort of thing isn't embraced. And perhaps at first it'll be a very niche cultural kind of thing. But I don't necessarily think that we're going to have people avoiding it forever either. It may be that humans 60,000 years into the future look extremely different because they have modified themselves in numerous ways. I mean, I can imagine being able to give yourself like electrically glittery skin or that kind of thing. You know, it's definitely in that realm of science fiction, you know, kind of anime style in a way. But I don't think it's necessarily beyond believability.
I think the prime time to introduce glittery skin body mods would have been, 5 or 6 years ago, whenever it was Twilight got big.
Really, it would have been in the mid-1970s David Bowie and glam rock.
Yeah.
Okay.
Either way, roller skates are going to be really necessary with that.
Yeah.
Well, I want to offer another concession to what you say is mm-hmm. that we may adapt to it. I've thought also that getting all Borged out could in the future become an example of a kind of performative consumption, right? So if it costs money to get cybernetic implants and things like
this.
It's
a status symbol.
Exactly. It could be the future's equivalent of wearing expensive jewelry and driving flashy sports cars. You advertise your financial value by gluing computer parts to your face and all this. You might even have people faking it, like they don't actually have cybernetic implants. They're just sticking stuff on their body.
So this would be an intermediary step from the brains in the jars, and my jar is bigger than your jar, saying.
It could be. And
my
facial
implant is bigger than your facial implant. Yeah.
If this were the case, it'd sort of be a question of competition between the need to show your value and this desire to fill the natural biophilia, if that, in fact, is true.
I can totally understand people saying that this hypothesis rings true, this biophilia hypothesis. Certainly, there are plenty of examples, if we just look at our fiction, of that being true, where you either have the perfect hero and the disfigured villain, or you have the disfigured hero whom everyone treats as a villain unfairly, simply because of their appearance. Yeah. But then it's revealed that this person is actually beautiful on the inside, and it becomes, you know, an object lesson for the reader.
A Quasimodo issue.
Yeah, exactly. So there's plenty of examples just in human experience that support this hypothesis. Obviously, that's not, you know, enough from a scientific perspective. It's merely anecdotal, but it's anecdotal supported by, at least in Western culture, hundreds of years of literature and theater and that sort of thing.
Well, and there are actual scientists debating this topic.
Sure.
It's not just pure speculation.
Right, right. No, I'm just saying that, you know, we don't have the scientific, consensus on this yet.
Yeah.
But there seems to be quite a bit of support from other parts of the human experience.
Or, you know, the other thing we could say is that even if it is a deeply rooted, deeply instinctual genetic predisposition we have to prefer things that look living versus things that look artificial today, maybe we'll evolve. That could be a thing that we change about ourselves.
So at any rate, this has really been a very interesting discussion. I mean, it is something that's interesting to think about. Like, what are people going to look like in the future? And we've got plenty of examples in science fiction of the idea of cosmetic surgery gone run amok, where people have taken what we consider to be, either the ideal or examples of outliers of cosmetic surgery today. And then they just multiply that by 100 so that we get these truly, at least to us, outrageous examples of modification. That, who knows? Perhaps in several thousand years, these things that seem completely extreme and ludicrous to us might not seem that way in the future.
The norm.
It may very well be that these things that we think are absurd now are just the norm. Yeah. So ultimately, when it comes down to what are humans going to look like in the future, we have to say we do not know.
Yeah.
There's no way of predicting it, because so many different factors are come into play when it comes to human appearance, and human preference is one of those, and that changes from generation to generation. So,
or minute to minute.
Yeah, it just takes me back to college. So anyway, guys, I think this was a fun topic. It was not something that we would normally tackle, right? It was a little bit outside of it. But I love that it's also in that kind of things that are not always addressed in science fiction realm. And I love that we're doing these sort of topics. So you guys, if you enjoy these topics, make sure you get in touch with us. Let us know what you like. Let us know if there are any topics specifically that you think we have to tackle. You know, why is it in science fiction films you never see X? And I'm sure we're going to get some interesting examples, and I can't wait to read them. So let us know on Twitter, on Facebook, or Google+. You can find us with the handle FWThinking, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Fedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Ariel. I moved to the U.S. at 19. I spoke no English and I struggled finding job opportunities. Everything I have, I owe to the Adult Literacy Center and getting my high school diploma at age 22.
It was an honor helping you achieve your greatness. Now you're helping others achieve theirs. It inspires me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Find free and supportive adult education centers near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.